Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. My name's Steve Diamond, and today is November 5th, 2005. Here's what's coming up. Tom Jackson interviews Norman Solomon, a nationally syndicated columnist on media and politics, and the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His latest book is War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. In our second hour, Jennifer Belkis talks with Jesse Connolly, campaign manager for Maine Won't Discriminate, Vote No on One campaign about the upcoming vote on November 8th in Maine. We'll also bring you people's history, great music, announcements, and more. First, some news. And now for some news you may have missed, starting with a local story from Foster's Daily Democrat. R&B artist shoots anti-war music video in Rollinsford. On the rolling hills behind a Route 4 farmhouse, surrounded by more than 2,000 pairs of military boots symbolizing the number of soldiers who have died in Iraq, Aiden Delgado, an Iraq war veteran, looked at the names of soldiers tagged to each boot as a camera mounted on the end of a large arm hovered over his head. Delgado is not an actor, but Tuesday he found himself in the middle of the making of an anti-war music video. The production is the latest project for blues singer Robert Cray for his song 20. Cray's latest song is a story of a 20-year-old soldier who objects to the war but goes to Iraq where he must guard an oil pipeline. He complains about the heat, his friends and civilians dying around him, and the extension of his duty before he's eventually killed, Cray said. I just want people to see what I deem as a war for no reason and only for greed, said Cray, who wrote 20 about a year ago. The video opens with a dead soldier, played by Delgado, looking through the lines of boots for his own pair. Once he finds the boots, he puts them on and dissolves into sand. Delgado, a former Army reservist, has many similarities to the soldier in the song, which is why the video's director, Sue Turner Cray, Cray's wife, chose him to participate. A conscientious objector to the war who was honorably discharged from the Army after a year of service in Nasiriyah, Iraq, and the Abu Ghraib prison, Delgado, a resident of Sarasota, Florida, embraced the anti-war peace movement upon his return to the United States. His firm stance has not been popular with everyone. Delgado said he has received death threats and had to change his email address because of peace movement work. And next, from Knight Ritter, Cheney's new security advisor linked to bogus information on Iraq. Vice President Dick Cheney replaced I. Lewis Scooter Libby as his national security advisor on Monday with an aide identified by a former Iraqi exile group as the White House official to whom it fed information on Iraq that turned out to be erroneous. The Bush administration relied on some of the information from the Iraqi National Congress to argue that Saddam Hussein had to be ousted before he could give banned biological or chemical weapons to al-Qaeda for strikes on the United States. But no such weapons were discovered after the March 2003 invasion, and U.S. intelligence agencies and the Independent Commission on the September 11, 2001 attacks found no evidence of operational cooperation between Iraq and al-Qaeda. The White House also announced that David S. Addington, who's been Cheney's legal counsel, would assume Libby's duty as chief of staff. Addington has played a quiet, though influential, role in the Vice President's office. Addington has been a key player behind widely criticized U.S. policies that have led to torture and other abuse of detainees held in Afghanistan and Iraq, according to Tom Malinowski, Washington Director of Human Rights Watch. He reportedly helped draft an opinion by then-White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez stating the Geneva Convention didn't apply to some detainees in the war on terrorism. This was somebody who worked very hard to make sure the advice of senior military officials and national security professionals on the question of interrogation policies was ignored, Malinowski said. The result was an unmitigated disaster for the United States. And next, from the Associated Press, Chavez gets chance to spar with Bush at summit. Venezuelan leader Hugo Chavez, emboldened by thousands of anti-American protesters, is getting a rare chance to stand up to his adversary, George Bush, with promises to keep the president from reviving talks on a free trade area stitched from Alaska to Argentina. The two men arrived in Argentina for the fourth summit of the Americas on Thursday, the same day Venezuela staged a mock U.S. invasion of its own territory. The event is the latest exercise intended to prepare soldiers and civilian volunteers for what Chavez says is a possible attack by American troops. U.S. officials deny any such plan, but Chavez says it's best to be ready, just in case. With tensions rising between the two nations, Chavez and Bush will likely see each other Friday at the summit's inauguration, after Chavez addresses a rally of mostly anti-Bush protesters. The two leaders are not scheduled to meet one-on-one, but they will both be taking part in the same summit sessions. The purpose of the summit is for democratically elected leaders to get together and reaffirm the fact that there is really a shared vision for the hemisphere, National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley said in a pre-summit briefing in Washington. There are signs the U.S. may be winning over supporters for the proposed free trade area of the Americas, the summit's main sticking point. A high-ranking Brazilian official, who said he wasn't authorized to give his name, told reporters that 28 of the 34 countries participating in the summit had agreed talks should begin as early as April. Negotiators missed a January 2005 deadline for wrapping up talks on the agreement. And here's another story about our neighbors to the south from the Interpress Service. Mexico defies Washington on the International Criminal Court. If Washington follows through on threats to slash aid to Mexico as punishment for its accession to the International Criminal Court, it risks further alienating key U.S. allies and drawing attention to its own increasingly shaky human rights record, say activists. There will be a price to be paid by the U.S. government in terms of its credibility, Richard Dicker, director of Human Rights Watch International Justice Program, told IPS. Mexico signed the Rome Statute of the ICC in September 2000, but did not ratify the treaty and formally deposit it with the United Nations until last week, on October 28th, making it the 100th nation to join the ICC. Washington had warned Mexico that if it ratified the ICC and refused to sign an accord exempting U.S. nationals from the court's jurisdiction, it would cut $11.5 million in funding from aid programs for fighting drug trafficking, according to human rights groups. The amount is equal to about 40% of the economic aid Mexico receives from the United States. However, Foreign Relations Secretary Luis Ernesto Derbez said last week that Mexico would not sign such an accord and was willing to lose the aid rather than give the United States special status. Almost every country in the European Union, 27 African countries, and all but four Latin American countries, Chile, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Nicaragua, have now joined the new court based in The Hague, which is empowered to prosecute individuals for genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity committed after July 1, 2002. The Nethercutt Amendment, passed by the U.S. Congress last year, cuts Economic Support Fund aid to countries that have ratified the ICC treaty but have not signed a bilateral immunity agreement with the United States. This includes funding for international counterterrorism efforts, peace process programs, anti-drug trafficking initiatives, truth and reconciliation commissions, wheelchair distribution, and HIV/AIDS education. Our ultimate goal is to conclude Article 98 agreements with every country in the world, regardless of whether they have signed or ratified the ICC, regardless of whether they intend to in the future, said John Bolton, former U.S. Undersecretary for Arms Control and current U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, and one of the ICC's staunchest opponents. The court is currently investigating cases in Darfur, Sudan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Uganda, where it recently issued arrest warrants for five top leaders of the Lord's Resistance Army, believed to have orchestrated tens of thousands of killings, abductions, and gender-based crimes during the course of the Uganda Civil War. And next, from the News and Observer, newsobserver.com. Military shares the public's declining support for Bush and the war. More than half of North Carolina military members surveyed in the latest Elon University poll disapprove of President Bush's handling of the war in Iraq and his overall job performance. Nearly 53% of military members said they strongly disapproved or disapproved of Bush's handling of his job, and just more than 56% of that same group strongly disapproved or disapproved of how he has dealt with the Iraq war. And finally, from the Angus Reid Global Scan at angusreid.com, Iraq conflict not worth fighting, say Americans. Many adults in the United States believe their federal administration should not have launched the coalition effort, according to a poll by CBS News. 64% of respondents believe the result of the war with Iraq was not worth the loss of American life and other costs. Yet, in George W. Bush's October 29th radio address, he ruled out any change to current policies, saying, "The best way to honor the sacrifice of our fallen troops is to complete the mission and win the war on terror."
Vietnam, so put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, like a two, like a three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. My, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.
move, let's move fast. The old big chance has come at last. Gotta go out, get those reds. The only good commie is one that's dead. And you know the peace could only be won when the golden rule of the kingdom come.
And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why we're being all gonna die. Boys up to Vietnam. Come on, folks, don't hesitate. Send them off before it's too late. Be the first one on your block to have your boy come home in a box.
And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die. That was Country Joe and the Fish with The Fish Cheer. We now go to an interview by Tom Jackson of Norman Solomon, a nationally syndicated columnist on media and politics and the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. His latest book is War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death.
My name is Tom Jackson, and I am talking with Norman Solomon today. Norman Solomon is a nationally syndicated columnist on media and politics. He's the founder of and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, a national consortium of policy researchers and analysts. And his columns have appeared in a tremendous amount of places, even mainstream media like the Washington Post, LA Times, USA Today. He has appeared on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, CNN, even Fox News. And his latest book is called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman Solomon, thanks for being with us today.
I'm glad to be with you.
Right from the get-go with the title of this book, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, I can hear neocons and their supporters making that sort of grumbling noise that they make when they're you know, confronted with a statement that they know somewhere deep down they can't really argue with, but of course they want to. You know, it's that sort of sort of thing. This is a great title and a great book. Can you give listeners a sort of outline of what the book is about?
Well, it's really about looking for patterns of the last five decades. And if neocons wanted to grumble about it, they'd have to acknowledge, and maybe this would make them less upset, that it's not in any way a partisan book and deals with ways in which presidents of both major political parties have used these mechanisms of media manipulation to build agendas for war. And while we've had all these changes in media technology and to some extent style in the last several decades, I found looking back from the early 1960s going through the present day there's not a heck of a lot new under the sun, that there are some boilerplate themes. They're, so to speak, drums that are beat on time after time. And when the White House is filled with people who are dead set about going to war, they find ways to get the reporters and pundits on board, and the rest is bloody history.
There's a little bit of the same thing going on with your book as with, say, Howard Zinn's A People's History of the United States, and that's that upon reading it, we see that the problems that we have today with the administration that's in the White House are actually not so new or unique. They may be magnified a bit in some respects, but they're not. They're really things that have been going on for quite some time.
There is continuity, and that's, I think, extremely important. On the one hand, people may react by feeling, well, gee, this has been so bad for so long. How can we change things? Wouldn't that be a discouraging sort of a realization? But I think that on the whole, we're much better equipped to deal with the current realities if we can put them in context, because a scam, when it keeps being run, is less effective when we can see the pattern. And so, just to give an example, this whole argument about not being willing to, quote, cut and run is not a new argument at all. And it was used by Lyndon Johnson. The same phrase was used, that you can't cut and run from Vietnam, just as President George W. Bush is using the same phrase about how you can't cut and run from Iraq. But a lot of the fallacies were present in both situations, and often they can be more quickly and clearly discerned when we look at a situation that, through the light of some decent rendition of history, we can see clearly that a war based on lies, with the U.S. troops engaged in warfare in a country where clearly most people do not want them, is just headed for disaster by any definition. And I think seeing that can be very helpful in clearing away a lot of fog about purported responsibility that the U.S. government has, we're told, to keep troops in Iraq.
Well, I do want to go back in a few minutes to the whole, you know, credibility thing, and we can't cut and run. But first, I'd like to go through a few chapters in your book and just have you talk about what you focus on in those chapters and bring it up to date with the current U.S. occupation of Iraq. And the first one I'd like to talk about, chapter 3, is called Our Leaders Would Never Tell Us Outright Lies.
Well, that's a popular mythology, and often it comes in the form that, oh, yes, this prior president, Nixon or Johnson or whoever, told flagrant, arrogant lies. But the current president wouldn't do that. It's kind of an exceptionalism of the present in relation to the past. It's also a kind of internalization of the idea, well, that was then, but this is now. And in fact, lying is quite continuous in terms of presidents who want to go to war. And I have to say, this was very striking to me, because when I went back from the early 1960s onward, I would have thought, depending on how one defines a war, the 8 or 10 major U.S. wars, certainly major for the people who fought in them and died in them, you would think that the law of averages would have at least some of those wars be based on fundamental truthfulness and not be based on some essential elements of deception. And yet, the law of averages are confounded, because every single war, from the invasion of the Dominican Republic and the buildup in Vietnam to the present war in Iraq, that the U.S. has been involved in and instigated, which is to say the same thing in the last several decades, every war of those has been based on fundamentally deception coming out of the White House. And sure, there were some truths thrown in, but outright lies have been fundamental, including the lie of omission. And Aldous Huxley wrote in the beginning of the introduction to Brave New World, he said, you know, lies are powerful, but even more powerful is silence about truth, which is a form of lie. As I quote Pentagon general saying during the Gulf War to a reporter from Newsday, we lie by not telling you things, and that is part of the process. So you go from the Gulf of Tonkin to the weapons of mass destruction claims where Cheney and Bush said that to a certainty there were WMDs in Iraq, lies have been just essential to the war-making process.
It does seem as though a really significant percentage of the U.S. population is willing to give every new leader, every new administration, even if it's filled with some of the people from the past, a clean slate. And I would imagine that's something that you have thought about and looked into. Why do you think that is, that there's this really consistent wiping of the slate with so many people in our country?
Well, you know, the corporate system, which spans through the military constituency, what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, now is so, the media are so corporatized, we could call it the military-industrial media complex, is not loyal to any one individual. And in fact, it's quite useful to render some of them expendable. I mean, I. Lewis Libby's being dangled out hung out to dry, so to speak. And I think that it's, you know, it's quite possible that Dick Cheney may be hung out to dry, and he may suddenly discover that he needs to spend a lot more time with his family, and there'll be a vacancy in the vice president's office. The system, if you will, is not dedicated to any individual, and they are expendable, and all of them, of course, will pass from the scene. And so this notion that we're starting anew, which has been thematic, really, of most presidencies, is very useful. You notice that Wall Street doesn't pack up and leave, and neither does the CIA. These are institutions that have their institutional processes that continue. It's about profits. It's about the massive wealth being accumulated by a relatively few number of people. When you look at the Chevron and Exxon Mobil and so forth, profits, you see just billions and billions of dollars in profits being racked up, while our tax dollars are being squandered to slaughter people in Iraq and bring about so many deaths of the Americans sent largely by economic draft to do that horrible work. And that is a process that continues beyond any individual. So when we have a new president in early 2009, no doubt we will be told that it is new beginnings. In the book, I quote I.F. Stone, the great journalist, at the time of the inauguration, the first inauguration of President Richard Nixon, saying that the presidents make us suckers. I'm paraphrasing here, but the presidents, the incoming ones, make us suckers for our hopes at the inaugurations. And he was, as usual, quite prophetic in that case.
Chapter 6 is called This Is Not at All About Oil or Corporate Profits. That's something that I have certainly heard in bird-dogging my four Republican representatives in the House and Senate. And, of course, we've all heard people in the Bush administration talk about it. Can you tell us about that?
There is often a lot of vilification of any who raise the question of corporate profits in wartime. I think it's quite remarkable. If you go back to World War II, then-Senator Harry Truman chaired hearings on Capitol Hill about war profiteering, and that was in the middle of World War II, a great true menace to the United States if the victory had gone to the other side. And yet this is a situation where there was willingness to look at war profiteering. There's very little willingness now beyond the rhetorical denunciations of, you know, Halliburton or Bechtel or whatever, because of closeness to Bush administration officials like Dick Cheney. But what bothers me most is the stuff that we don't hear about, that despite the denials and aspersions against those who raise these issues, if you look at, say, the annual reports, as I did, of Pentagon contracting companies, and I don't call them defense contractors, I call them military contractors, whatever the size, you find an extreme reliance on the process of profit-taking from contracts with the so-called Defense Department. So when I went through the annual reports, whether it was Orbit International Corporation, which is a small company, or Engineered Support Systems, which has about $500 million in sales as of last year, and then you have the mammoth Northrop Grumman with over $26 billion in revenues in the last couple of years annually, you've got this constant acknowledgement in their annual reports that they are depending on war. They're depending on, well, here's wording from Orbit International Corporation. We are heavily dependent upon military spending as a source of revenues and income. Accordingly, any substantial future reductions in overall military spending by the U.S. government could have a material adverse effect on our sales and earnings. Well, this is true of these contractors. And then you go to questions about oil. Does anybody seriously think that if there were not a drop of oil under the sand in Iraq instead of an estimated 112 billion barrels, that we would have U.S. troops there today?
Chapter 12 is called "This is a Necessary Battle in the War on Terrorism," of course, almost mantra that's repeated by Bush and Bush administration officials. Tell us about that chapter.
It is a mantra, and the way in which it has dominated the news media and the spin for war has been really oftentimes overwhelming in the political arena. I think it's worth noting, as I do in the book, that this is not a new theme. It has just been enormously pumped up. In 1964, when there were efforts with a proposal from the French government to reconvene the Geneva Conference to find some kind of peaceful solutions to the war in Vietnam and elsewhere in Southeast Asia, the response from Lyndon Johnson was that, and I'm quoting here, the proposal would, quote, ratify terror, unquote. And in fact, there was a theme in U.S. media coverage that the U.S. war in Vietnam was opposing terrorism. And so anytime there are guerrillas involved in fighting the U.S. occupying force, they have been called terrorists in the U.S. media. But now that is obviously, as you say, a mantra. And I, in the book, raise the question about whether we're going to have a single standard of terrorism, and for that matter, human rights. Will we apply the same standard? On 9/11, when the horrible tragedy happened, the crime of 9/11 occurred, Colin Powell was in Latin America, and he immediately issued a statement condemning those who he said would destroy buildings and kill people for political purposes. Well, that is something that various successive U.S. administrations have done in terms of, for instance, killing, according to the Pentagon, 100,000 people during 6 weeks in the Gulf War in early 1991, a war that Colin Powell was, of course, made a hero out of as a general, as a leader, with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so forth. And yet, when you look at the questions that were raised of Colin Powell right after the Gulf War, he was asked about the statistics of how many Iraqis had been killed, and he said, and I quote this in the book, that's not a number I'm very interested in. And in fact, the top U.S. officials have shown they're not interested in the people who have been killed, the numbers, who they were, by U.S. firepower. And the rationale is that we're good and we're now fighting terrorism. But the reality is, when civilians are predictably killed by U.S. Weaponry and military actions, that is experienced by them as terror. They are being terrorized from their vantage point. And for us to say, well, that doesn't matter because we know different, because our intentions are good, it really doesn't get very far. It's not very convincing in the world avenue. I also quote the New York Times journalist Chris Hedges in his book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. He talks about how killing civilians is often presented as a way of sending a message, and he recounts that the bombing of Vietnam by the United States was described by then Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara as a way to send a message, as he put it, to the communist rulers in Hanoi. And Hedges, who covered the Gulf War for the New York Times, comments, not in the Times, but in his book, that this message is this idea that you can send messages, that you should send messages by slaughtering people, is common to people with many different ideologies, and he mentions among them not only McNamara, but Osama bin Laden and George W. Bush.
You're listening to WSCA LP 106.1 FM in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. My name's Tom Jackson, and I am talking with Norman Solomon. His new book is called War Made Easy: How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. The final chapter in your book is called Withdrawal Would Cripple U.S. Credibility. And it seems to me that that, perhaps more than any other mantra, if you want to call it that, has been used over the last several months. And one can certainly hear not only Bush administration officials and Republicans, but also many Democrats have been saying that for quite some time.
Yes, this is very much where we are politically in terms of the Iraq war when it comes to mainstream media and politics on Capitol Hill. And almost invariably, and it's certainly the case now, the public is ahead of the politicians and what's been called the punditocracy. If you look at the polls, about a third of the U.S. population wants immediate complete withdrawal of U.S. troops. And quite a lot of others at least want such a process to begin immediately. But when you look on Capitol Hill, you find very few members of Congress who are willing to speak, especially in the Senate, where there's more of a capability to get a high-profile media response. There's more of a capability through the filibuster to actually impede war appropriations. You have very few members of the Senate willing to come close to demanding immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Iraq. And yet, you look at the Vietnam parallels, they're quite chilling, and the U.S. troops can come out now or they can come out later. If they come out later, there will be really nothing accomplished but more killing.
I wanted to also have you talk for a few minutes, if you would, about you're the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. And I guess I'm wondering, given what we were saying before about how so much of what you talk about in War Made Easy is not really new stuff. You go back, you know, for several administrations and really point out how it's been kind of going this way for quite some time. Is the work of the Institute for Public Accuracy more intense, I guess would be a word for it, post 9/11 or since the Bush administration has come into power? Or is that, again, something that isn't all that different?
Well, I think that our basic task is the same, but it has become more intense in the last few years, largely because we are in a permanent warfare state now, and the Bush administration has made good on a promise that was made in the form of an op-ed piece in the New York Times 16 days after 9/11, a piece by Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, where essentially he did promise a war without end, a perpetual war, with no exit strategies, no timelines. And that has meant at the Institute for Public Accuracy, which was founded partway through the second term of President Bill Clinton, that we need to come very much to terms with the militarization of not only U.S. foreign policy, but of the domestic policy as well, what is done to our budgets, the militarism in the rhetoric, and what we are confronting in terms of the political economy and the priorities that are reflected in the federal budget with so many damaging effects domestically. So we were very much, as an organization, challenging a lot of the assumptions of the Clinton administration, the war in Yugoslavia, the bombing that went on for 78 straight days. As you know from reading my book, I talk in there about something that the Institute for Public Accuracy was one of the few organizations to raise with literally thousands of media outlets to very little effect, and that was the manipulation of the Rambouillet talks prior to the beginning of the U.S. bombing of Yugoslavia in early 1999. And so we were swimming upstream then and challenging a lot of what was accepted and supported by the Democratic Party. But since 9/11, we've had really had to challenge a lot about the way in which the meaning of 9/11 has been framed and the way in which U.S. military actions since then have been rationalized by the White House and by much of the press.
Going back to one more of the chapters in your book, War Made Easy, Chapter 5 is called This Is About Human Rights. And in a certain sense, especially when it's applied to the response from supporters of a continued occupation of Iraq, you know, when they're challenged about that. Quite often what I'm hearing is about that this is about human rights, or with the term democracy almost used interchangeably, that this is all about bringing democracy to that region. Talk to us about that and what your perception of what is happening really in Iraq today.
Well, I'd be all for a foreign policy based on human rights if there were consistency there. And so when we're told that it was necessary to go to war on Iraq because it was a horrific regime that tortured its citizens, which is certainly true, it was horrific, it did engage in torture, then why is the U.S., for instance, giving a couple of billion dollars a year to the Egyptian government, which routinely tortures its political prisoners, of which it has an appreciable amount? These are questions that simply are not raised in the U.S. news media, and I think the answers that have to do with just a fundamental hypocrisy, that U.S. foreign policy is not based on a regard for human rights. It's oblivious to human rights. It uses human rights as an argument when there are other policy goals to be implemented by what's called diplomacy or by warfare, by economic strangulation or whatever. But we really have no way to make a case that there's a human rights theme played out with any consistency in U.S. foreign policy. And in point of fact, since 9/11, and I quote the Secretary General of Amnesty International, Irene Khan, to this effect in the book, what has happened is that Washington has promoted abuses of human rights to an extreme around the world. Through example, you know, what happened with Guantanamo Bay prisoners and continues to happen there, with the U.S. publicly thumbing its nose at Geneva Conventions and asserting their right, which continues to this moment, to torture prisoners of the U.S. government. This is a way that then winks and nods and gives license to regimes like the Putin government in Russia to engage in their own so-called war on terror, which actually is continuation in Chechnya of simply a war where the central government is willing to kill large numbers of people for its own purposes.
Well, one question that comes to mind, and this is something that in the past I've had to sort of deal with myself, when a concerned citizen, someone who's concerned about what the U.S. foreign policy is and how accurate is the information we're getting from mainstream media, is there a perpetuation of myths, lies, and half-truths, and so on, it can be overwhelming, not only in terms of sort of facing the Goliath of the military-industrial complex, but one could certainly add media to that complex nowadays. It's just an endless barrage of information that is often at best questionable, and one could certainly employ lots of people to respond to all of that information full-time, 24/7. What do you have for suggestions for people who are concerned and, you know, maybe at some point have felt ready to just toss their hands up and say, forget about it, you know, there's nothing I can do about it? What can people do to counter this military-industrial media complex?
Well, as discouraging as things can be right now, things would be worse if people weren't organizing, if we didn't have low-power radio and community radio and websites and independent print outlets and video makers and writers and others who are simply saying that we do not accept the militarization of our society and that we're going to continue to dig for information and to share it with as many people as we can and to build social movements that challenge what Martin Luther King called the madness of militarism. This is obviously sometimes an overwhelming task to even contemplate, and no one person can do a whole heck of a lot. But there is a movement underway, and it's flawed. It has a lot of weaknesses. There are a lot of fractionations of it, but there is a peace and social justice movement, or movements, if you will. It ties into the labor movement, environmental movement, civil rights movement, the struggle for civil liberties. It has many fronts, many avenues, from lobbying to civil disobedience to public demonstrations to educational campaigns and all the rest of it. The electoral arena clearly very important as well. And the alternative to challenging this horrendous status quo is to be passive, to be consuming history instead of trying to constructively affect it. I think that is the more discouraging possibility. That option is guaranteed to be a disaster. And so even though, as I say, there are many reasons to be discouraged, I very much identify with something that Antonio Gramsci wrote when he was imprisoned under Mussolini. He talked about the need of pessimism for the intellect and optimism of the will. And I think that while we have many reasons to be pessimistic, there is the will, the determination that people have had throughout the course of human history, and we certainly have it today, to say we're not going to give up and we're going to create positive change.
Norman Solomon's new book is called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman, I know you've been doing some touring, including a little bit of touring on the West Coast with David Rovics recently. How's the touring been? How's the response been?
Well, it was very encouraging to go from one community to another, often small towns or medium-sized cities, up from San Francisco to Arcata and Roanoke Park and Eugene and Grass Valley and towns where people are quite active. Often there's a community radio station and or some independent weekly or monthly print publications. And David Rovics is such a terrific songwriter and musician and singer and really energized people. And so I found that encouraging, that just about anywhere you go in the country, if you look for it, you'll find people who are active in social justice work.
And Norman Solomon will be coming to the New England area, including New Hampshire Peace Action's annual dinner, which is Friday, November 11th at the Concord High School on Pleasant Street in Concord. And the lineup for that is Silent Auction and Fellowship at 5 o'clock, dinner at 6 o'clock. And then Norman Solomon gives the keynote address at 7:15 p.m. Tell us where else you're going to be in the upcoming Northeast tour.
Well, a fair amount of travel. I'm going to be in Rutland, Vermont, and the sponsors of the event in Concord are in touch with the folks up in Vermont. That's going to be the following night, Saturday night, the 12th. And then I'll be in Providence, it looks like, the night of the 13th, the Sunday night, and that's being sponsored by the Green City Council member, David Siegel. So anybody down that way in Providence can get hold of David Siegel's office and get the details. I should say, too, that there's info about what I've been up to and the War Made Easy book at the site warmadeeasy.com. And for good measure, we were talking about the Institute for Public Accuracy. We have more than 1,000 news releases that we've put out in the last 8 years posted and archived permanently on our site, which is accuracy.org.
And I know you're also published frequently on many different websites, including commondreams.org. And where else? So how about MediaBeat?
Well, my column is out on a number of sites, including it's archived at normansolomon.com. Truthout.org often has my stuff up there. The Media Watch Group Fair site also has my column there, which is fair.org. And that in its own right, we're talking about the military-industrial media complex. Fair is a very important organization, I believe, to challenge media spin and corporate power through information flow. And I'd urge anybody who would like to be more active on media issues, make a habit of going to the FAIR site. It's FAIR.org. And among other things, you can sign up to get on its media activism list, which now has about 80,000 people, for action alerts.
Norman Solomon's new book is called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Hey, thank you.
He's done giving orders to generals. He's moved to another sphere. He's through with ordering the tanks to kill. He's gonna do something different this year. He's moving from Virginia to Washington with the neocons to thank. He's through with the War Department. Now he's gonna run the World Bank. He said he'd be true to the mission That hunger and want should end. And as all Afghans know, he's a man of his word. On that we can depend. So be prepared for prosperity. It's coming to your door. 'Cause there will be no poverty once we kill off all the poor. Last week he was bombing cities. Now he's a financier. Pay your debts or say goodbye. Paul Wolfowitz is here. He'll bring the world things it needs, such as nuclear power, giant dams, and hamburgers. No doubt he's a man of the hour. He's proven it over and over with finesse and aplomb. And for those who disagree, well, then he's got the bomb. Last week he was bombing cities, now he's a financier. Pay your debts or say goodbye, Paul Wolfowitz is here. He's a real American, so he must know best. He'll lead us to glory, on this many can attest. He'll lead us to freedom, and we will be so glad. Just like those shoppers in that market in downtown Baghdad. Last week he was bombing cities, now he's a financier. Pay your debts or say goodbye, Paul Wolfowitz is here.
That song was called Paul Wolfowitz by Dave Rovix. Before that, we had an interview with Norman Solomon. Once again, don't miss the opportunity to see him speak here in New Hampshire next week. On Friday, November 11th at 5 p.m., he'll be speaking at the New Hampshire Peace Action Annual Dinner in Concord High School. For more information, contact Ann Miller at 603-228-0559 or email ann@nhpeaceaction.org. That's ANNE@nhpeaceaction.org. Next, it's time for some people's history and an article about Rosa Parks by Steve Chase, the director of the Department of Environmental Studies Environmental Advocacy and Organizing Program at Antioch College Graduate School, printed in the Keene Sentinel, November 1, 2005, called Thank You, Rosa Parks. 4 years ago, I founded a one-of-a-kind master's program at Antioch New England Graduate School to train public interest advocates and grassroots organizers working for environmental protection, corporate accountability, and social justice. People have occasionally asked me what inspired me to dream up the environmental advocacy and organizing program. My answer is always the same, Rosa Parks. Parks, who died at home last week, became famous in 1955 when she refused to move to the back of a segregated bus for a white man. She was immediately arrested, and her act of defiance sparked the Montgomery bus boycott, which won the first major victory against legal segregation in the South and launched a national movement for civil rights. People can usually see how Rosa Parks sparked my interest in nonviolent activism for the common good. What they don't see is how she inspired my interest in activist training and education. Like most people, I used to think that Rosa Parks was just a tired, middle-aged seamstress who got fed up with the indignities of racism on the evening of December 1, 1955. However, when I was a teenager, an older Quaker activist told me the real story of Rosa Parks. For starters, Parks was a seasoned activist, not a novice. She had been an active member of her local NAACP chapter for over 12 years before refusing to move to the back of the bus, and she had participated in many discussions about how to launch a successful campaign against segregation. Contrary to the conventional story, her act of civil disobedience was pre-planned and aimed at sparking a powerful movement for freedom. Secondly, Parks was a trained activist. The summer before her famous act of civil disobedience, Parks attended a 10-day activist training workshop at the Highland Folk School in Tennessee. During a radio interview years before, Studs Terkel asked Parks what role Highlander played in her decision to act. Parks answered, "Everything." Highlander Folk School was founded in the 1930s by Miles Horton. His vision for the school was to bring poor and oppressed people together, encourage them to grapple with their everyday social problems, provide an area for deep political reflection, and ultimately provide training workshops in the skills and strategies of social movement organizing. During the 1930s and the early 1940s, Highlander focused its education programs on the Southern labor movement. By the early 1950s, Highlander moved into civil rights activism, and Horton brought together blacks and whites interested in confronting the problem of segregation. To deepen the effectiveness of his work, Horton hired Septima Clark, the school's first black staff member, as his education director. A public school teacher who had been fired and blacklisted because of her volunteer work with the NAACP, Clark cemented Highlanders' ties over the years with many of the people who eventually became leaders of such groups as the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. At Highlander, these people were encouraged by both Horton and Clark to take what they learned and apply it in their own communities. As Horton said to generations of participants at Highlander's training workshops, "The way to use this information is not to say that we have learned a lot, and isn't it wonderful and great to have been at Highlander. You're here to act on it. This is education for action. Now, how are you going to act on this? Let's just plan what you're going to do when you get back." In her own recollection of Park's first visit to Highlander, Septima Clark reports how Parks struggled with her fears over taking the kind of daring actions against segregation being discussed by workshop participants and Highlander's trainers. As Clark remembers it, "Rosa Parks was afraid for white people to know she was as militant as she was. She didn't even want to speak before the whites that she met at Highlander because she was afraid they would take it back to the whites in Montgomery. After she talked it out in that workshop that morning and she went back home, then she decided that, 'I'm not going to move out of that seat.'" With her dramatic action a few months later, Parks earned her diploma from Highlander and rightly became revered as the grandmother of the 1960s civil rights movement. Unknown to her, she also inspired the creation of a 2-year activist training program in Keene, New Hampshire, a little over 45 years after her big day. Thank you, Rosa Parks.
Across the lines, who would dare to go under the bridge, over the tracks that separates whites from blacks? Choose sides. Run for your lives. Tonight the riots begin. In back streets of America, they kill the dream of America. Little black girl gets assaulted. No reason why. News prints a story. Racist tempers fight. Next day starts a riot. Knives and guns are drawn. Two black boys get killed. One white boy goes blind. Across the lines, who would dare to go under the bridge, over the tracks that separates whites from blacks? Run for your lives. Tonight the riots begin. Back streets of America, they kill the dream of America. Little black girl gets assaulted. No one know her name. Lots of people hurt and angry. She's the one to blame. Across the lines, who would dare to go under the bridge, over the tracks that separates whites from blacks? Choose sides. Run for your lives. Tonight the riots begin. Back streets of America, they kill the dream of America.
That was Across the Lines by Tracy Chapman. To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.